Hello. Today is Monday, April 26th, and it is time to read from the Sioux City Journal. My name is Barb, and I'm happy to be with you today. We're going to be reading local stories of interest. We'll start with the weather and the mini editorial. Then we'll move to the front page stories, and then throughout the paper as the hour continues. So let's get started. Wow, today's weather forecast, warmer with times of clouds and sun, high of 85. Tonight, a little cloudy and breezy, low of 57. On Tuesday, cooler with a shower and a possible thunderstorm, high of 71, low of 47. Wednesday, intervals of clouds and sun, high of 65, low 41. Thursday, sunshine, breezy in the afternoon, high of 71. Low of 43, and Friday, partly sunny, nice and warm. High of 80, and a low of 47, so it looks like a lovely week. More summer-like conditions coming up. Hope you get a chance to get out and enjoy it. So we're going to move back to the front page, see what's happening. Today's mini editorial is brought to us by the Sioux City Journal Editorial Board. This week, 24 women's volleyball teams from around the country will compete in the NAIA National Tournament at the Tyson Event Center. If you happen to encounter members of a team or their fans, take a moment to welcome them to Sioux City and wish them luck. And this is written by the Sioux City Journal Editorial Board. Excuse me, let's go on now to the front page stories. Events to educate about the Holocaust. There's a large picture of acclaimed filmmaker, Roberta Grossman, who will speak following a 7 p.m. Wednesday screening of the film Who Will Write Our History during Tolerance Week in Sioux City. Like all other Holocaust-related programming during the Monday through Friday week of remembrances, Grossman's documentary and commentary will be accessible only online due to the COVID-19 restrictions. Excuse me, the title is A Solemn Remembrance. Tolerance Week goes online due to COVID. The Holocaust was one of the darkest moments in the 20th century. Its ghastly history has been exposed and denounced in countless speeches, photos, and documentary films ever since. However, Sioux City's five-day series of Tolerance Week programming, A Remembrance of the Holocaust, has been dramatically altered due to a very 21st century reason. Because of COVID-19 concerns, all of our activities will be online, said Luann Lindblade, one of the event's organizers. This year, Tolerance Week observance will be a virtual one. Tolerance Week programming is free and will be accessible via toleranceweek.org and facebook.com/toleranceweek. Sioux City's Tolerance Week was created in 2005 by Jerry and Kathy Weiner after the couple saw a movie called Paperclips, a critically acclaimed documentary film featuring middle school kids in Tennessee who collected 6 million paperclips to represent the 6 million Jews killed by the Nazis during World War II. Since then, the Holocaust has become a part of the curriculum for many Sioux City middle schools, with eighth graders taking part in Tolerance Week activities in their own school districts, as well as in the special programming held at the Orpheum. That was until 2020, when the coronavirus pandemic closed down schools in the Orpheum mere days before Tolerance Week was slated to start. That means an entire class of eighth graders were not able to experience last year's Tolerance Week. Even though COVID is still part of everyone's lives, we moved our activities online for the sake of this year's eighth graders and the now ninth graders who missed out last year, as well as anyone wanting to learn more about the Holocaust. 2021's Virtual Tolerance Week, a partnership between Humanities Iowa, the National Endowment for the Humanities, and Kathy and Jerry Weiner, will include Facing Fear, a documentary centering on Matthew Boger, a 13-year-old who was thrown out of his house for being gay. Living on the streets, he was beaten by a group of neo-Nazi skinheads. 25 years later, he had a chance to meet with one of the former neo-Nazi skinheads, and a friendship ensued. shown at 6 p.m. Monday, the Facing Fear screening, a partnership between Tolerance Week and the Sioux City Human Rights Commission, will include a discussion with Sioux City Human Rights Commission Director Karen Mackey. A virtual screening of Above and Beyond, a documentary about heroic Jewish American pilots that was being produced by Nancy Spielberg, the younger sister of Steven Spielberg, will take place at 6 p.m. on Tuesday. On Wednesday at 7 p.m., the documentary Who Will Write Our History will be screened. Roberta Grossman, the movie's writer, director, and producer, will make comments after the screening. Other activities will include the naming of winners for the annual Tolerance Week Essay Contest and the Ella Holtzman Memorial Tolerance Week Art Contest. Both events, open to middle and high school students, include cash prizes. The art contest was renamed in honor of Ella Holtzman, a 2016 middle school art contest winner who died with her brother Beck in an ICE-related car accident. An interactive event with Terezin concentration camp survivor Inga Oerbacher will take place at 9:30 a.m. on Wednesday. Eighth graders will have read her book, I Am a Star, Child of the Holocaust, and will be given the opportunity to ask her questions. In addition, photos of Vernon Tott, an Orange City native who helped free survivors of the Alam labor camp in Hanover, Germany, will be presented as a visual art exhibit by the Sioux City Public Museum, another partner of Tolerance Week. We couldn't have Tolerance Week without the collaboration of so many and other organizations, said Lindblad. And while having a virtual Tolerance Week doesn't occur under normal circumstances, Lindblad thinks it can have a positive impact. We'll be able to have a larger audience by going virtual, she said. Go back now to our front page stories. The headline is Michigan is latest hotspot. COVID infections are increasing. In Royal Oak, Michigan, Eric Galla passed up an opportunity to get a vaccine when shots became available in Michigan, and he admits not taking the virus seriously enough. Then he got sick with what he thought was the flu. He thought he would sweat it out and feel back to normal. Before long, the 63-year-old retiree was in a hospital hooked up to a machine to help him breathe. He had COVID-19. I was having more trouble breathing and they turned the oxygen up higher. That's when I got scared and thought I wasn't going to make it, a visibly weary Galla told the Associated Press on Wednesday from his hospital bed at Beaumont Hospital in Royal Oak, north of Detroit. I had so many people tell me this was a fake disease. Galla's situation illustrates how Michigan has become the current national hotspot for COVID-19 infections and hospitalizations at a time when more than half the U.S. population has been vaccinated and other states have seen the virus diminish substantially. Doctors, medical professionals, and public health officials point to a number of factors that explain how the situation has gotten bad in Michigan. More contagious variants, especially in the mutation first discovered in Britain, have taken root here with greater prevalence than other states. Residents have emerged from harsh, lengthy state restrictions on dining and crowd sizes, and abandoned mask wearing and social distancing, especially in rural northern parts of the state that had largely avoided severe outbreaks. The state had also had average vaccine compliance. Michigan has recorded a highest in the nation 91,000 new cases over the last 2 weeks, despite improvements in the number in the recent days. By comparison, that is more than California and Texas had combined in the same period. Beaumont Health, a major hospital system in Michigan, recently warned that its hospital and staff had hit critical capacity levels. COVID-19 patient numbers across the 8 hospital system jumped from 128 on February 28th to more than 800. A year ago, the phrase was tsunami, said Dr. Paul Boyzik, Assistant Chief of Critical Care and Pulmonary Medicine at Beaumont Royal Oak. It was chaotic. People were overwhelmed with what they were seeing, death and dying. This year, it's more of a slow rising flood. No big surge of patients, but we're getting more each day, and we are full. Meanwhile, President Joe Biden says the U.S. is determined to help India as it grapples with a surge in coronavirus cases. In a tweet Sunday, Biden said, "Just as India sent assistance to the U.S. as our hospitals were strained early in the pandemic, we are determined to help India in its time of need." The president didn't offer specifics, but earlier Sunday, the White House said the U.S. is working around the clock to immediately deploy to India drug treatments and rapid COVID-19 testing kits. Also coming are ventilators and PPE, and the U.S. will seek to provide oxygen supplies as well. For the fourth straight day, India on Sunday set a global daily record of new infections, spurred by the insidious new variant that emerged here. The surge has undermined the government's premature claims of victory over the pandemic. The 349,000 confirmed infections over the past day brought India's total to more than 16.9 million cases, behind only the U.S. The health ministry reported another 2,800 deaths in the last 24 hours, pushing their fatality rate to over 192,000. Experts say this toll could be a huge undercount, as suspected cases are not included, and many deaths are being attributed to underlying conditions. The unfolding crisis is most visceral in India's overwhelmed graveyards and crematoriums, and in heartbreaking images of gasping patients dying on their way to hospitals due to the lack of oxygen. Burial grounds in the capital, New Delhi, are running out of space. Bright, glowing funeral pyres light up the night sky in other badly hit cities. In the central city of Bhopal, some crematoriums have increased their capacity from dozens to more than 50, yet officials say there are still hour-long waits. At the city's crematorium, workers say they cremated more than 110 people on Saturday, even as the government figures in the entire city of 1.8 million, put the total number of virus deaths at just 10. "The virus is swallowing our city's people like a monster," said an official at the site. The unprecedented rush of bodies has forced the crematorium to skip individual ceremonies and exhaustive rituals that Hindus believe release the soul from the cycle of rebirth. "We're just burning bodies as they arrive. It's as if we're in the middle of a war." The head grave digger at New Delhi's largest Muslim cemetery, where 1,000 people have been buried during the pandemic, said more bodies are arriving now than last year. "I fear we will run out of space very soon." Okay, we're going to go back now to another front page story, and that is counties decline vaccine allotments. Demand for the shots is waning across Iowa. Most northwest Iowa counties declined new vaccine allotments this past week, as demand for the vaccine is apparently beginning to fall below supply. Counties of Woodbury, Sioux, Ida, Sac, Lyon, Clay, O'Brien, Buena Vista, Dickinson, and Crawford all declined some or all of the new vaccine shipments from the state this past week. In all, 43 of the 99 Iowa counties turned down vaccine supply, twice the number of counties that declined new vaccines the week prior. For Woodbury, Sac, Lyon, Clay, and Crawford counties, this was the second week in a row that shipments were turned down. Iowa has asked the federal government to withhold more than a quarter of its allotment of the vaccines this week because demand for the shots have waned. The Iowa Department of Public Health told the Des Moines Register on Saturday that the state declined to accept 18,000 of the 34 doses of Moderna that was slated to receive this week, and declined 3,500 of the 46,000 doses of the Pfizer vaccine. Along with several other states, we're seeing a slowdown of vaccine administration, but we're working with our local partners and community leaders to determine where additional education is needed to gain an understanding of the needs of each county's unique population. State officials have implored Iowans to take the vaccine. Lieutenant Governor Adam Gregg even came to Sioux City along with former Iowa football star Dallas Clark to take a shot at the Siouxland Expo Center. The lieutenant governor noted that men in Iowa seem to be more hesitant about the vaccine than women. "We're concerned that disparity is going to grow. Guys, why are we falling short? we're here to persuade you that it's the right thing to do for you, your family, and your community. By getting a vaccine, you're protecting your loved ones. Between 14 counties in the Siouxland region, an average of roughly 30% of all residents are fully vaccinated. The Northwest Iowa counties with the highest vaccine rates, Buena Vista and Dickinson at 36 and 34% fully vaccinated respectively, were among those to decline new vaccine allotments, as were Lyon and Sioux counties. The Iowa Department of Health on Friday recommended that vaccine providers resume the use of the single-dose Johnson & Johnson vaccine following the lead of the CDC and the FDA, which lifted a pause on the vaccine last week. The pause was prompted by a rare blood clot found in six people who received the shot. Five counties in northwest Iowa made heavy use of the Johnson & Johnson shot before the pause. Most other northwest Iowa counties had only distributed at most a few hundred J&J doses, with the bulk of their vaccines being either Moderna or Pfizer. I think that's it for our front page news. And we're going to move inside now. Iowa legislative leaders call for ban on vaccine passports. Iowa governments would be barred from issuing vaccine passports to people as proof that they have received the COVID-19 vaccinations. And businesses and venues open to the public could face penalties if they require immunization proof under a bill legislators are slated to take up this week. House File 889, sponsored by Matt Windischel of Missouri Valley, has been introduced after Governor Kim Reynolds said on April 7th she strongly opposes any mandatory vaccination disclosure system as an attack on our liberties and freedoms and would take steps to restrict it through legislation of her own or executive order. The governor said vaccination passports pose constitutional, civil, and privacy issues and potentially set up a two-tiered society requiring Iowans either to engage or become marginalized. The legislation, slated to come before a House Judiciary Subcommittee Monday, even as lawmakers aim for a target adjournment of Friday, seeks to prohibit the mandatory disclosure of whether a person has received the vaccination and proposes to bar any governmental entity or business that requires such proof in violation of the new law that receiving any grants and contracts funded by state revenue. The legislation, which has a companion leadership bill by Senate Majority Leader Jack Whitfer of Ankeny, makes exceptions for healthcare facilities. Iowans have been loud and clear. They want their medical freedoms protected, said Pat Grassley. The governor agreed addressing vaccine passports is a priority, so the Iowa House is working to find a legislative solution to address the concerns of Iowans. Under the proposal, the new state law would take effect upon Reynolds' signature, which would prohibit state and local government entities from producing identification cards that identify whether the cardholder has received a vaccination for COVID-19. Also, government and entities and businesses holding a sales tax permit, nonprofit or for not-for-profit organizations, or an establishment open to the public at large or where entrance is limited by a cover charge or membership requirement, will not be able to require a patron or other person who is invited into the premise to furnish proof of COVID-19 vaccinations. HF 89 does not prohibit a business or government from implementing a COVID-19 screening protocol as long as it does not include a required proof of the vaccination. I'm regularly asked how we get back to normal in the wake of the coronavirus, Whitfer said. The first step is Iowans getting vaccinated, and the state has made tremendous progress on this front. I encourage Iowans not yet vaccinated to schedule an appointment. A return to normal must not include having to show your government-issued vaccination papers to access routine functions of life in Iowa, like going to a game or concert or church. This legislation is to prohibit mandatory vaccination passports in a shared priority of Governor Reynolds, the Iowa Senate, and Iowa House. I look forward to advancing this bill. Democrats, who are outnumbered 59-41 in the Iowa House, 32-18 in the Senate, have said they do not see the need to enact a state ban on vaccination passports, but believe there are steps lawmakers could take to help Iowans hard hit by the pandemic and the economic, health, and social challenges it has created. Congressional leaders, the Biden administration, said they're not doing it. House leader, Democratic leader Todd Pritchard of Charles City said in response to the governor's call for the ban. I think this is just kind of a red herring discussion to take attention away from some of the problems she's having in her response. Biden administration officials have announced they would not create a federal vaccine passport or credential system or require travelers or businesses to be inoculated. But Iowa Republicans say federal officials may change their position or policies. So far, the push to develop digital proof has come from businesses, including airlines and sport venues, which have been experimenting with such systems. While I believe in the efficacy of the vaccine enough to get it myself and encourage Iowans to do the same, I also respect it's a personal choice, said Reynolds in a news conference on April 7th. But I strongly oppose vaccine passports and believe that we must take a stand as a state against them, which I intend to do either through legislation or executive action. The governor is encouraging Iowans to get vaccinated as soon as possible, taking whichever form of vaccine they choose. At the same time, she said deciding to be vaccinated should be personal choice and not required by the state. Instead of trying to solve a problem that doesn't exist, Democrats said State House Republicans should be focusing on other problems associated with the COVID-19 pandemic. I wish she would have had this kind of laser focus proactively and preemptively on getting vaccines into Iowans' arms earlier that she's having on vaccine passports, said Jennifer Cohn-First of Windsor Heights. Monday marks the 106th calendar day of the 2021 legislation session, but Grassley has been hesitant to predict that this week will be the last, with much of the $8 billion plus state budget plan for fiscal 2022 awaiting floor action in both chambers, along with the GOP tax cut proposals. Reynolds' priorities in housing, renewable energy, and education, and a dwindling array of policy changes that include the newly arriving vaccine passport topic. One thing that may spur action is the fact that the daily expense money that House and Senate members receive, $129 for some and $172 for the others, ends on Friday. Even with the end of the per diem, Senate Democratic leader Zach Walls of Coralville told reporters Thursday he projected the session would not end until May 15th. But on April 8th, he said, I would say that the odds that Iowa adapts vaccine passports are about the same as me being the starting quarterback for the Green Bay Packers. It's not going to happen. We'll continue on now and see what else we have going on. Oh, here's a review of the Sioux City Symphony Orchestra performance from Saturday night. Two former featured artists gave the Sioux City Symphony Orchestra a memorable performance of Aaron Copland's Appalachian Spring on Saturday night. Seamlessly stitching their parts into the fabric of a flowing simple gifts, clarinetist Miles Jacques and flautist Brian Allred ensured Sioux City's love affair with Copland. His rodeo is an oft-performed piece was secure. Originally created for dancer choreographer Martha Graham, the embraceable music tracks the dawn of a day, letting the 13 members of the orchestra awaken familiar sounds, including the Shaker hymn Simple Gifts. Allred and Jacques were instrumental in creating the musical quilt. Jacques figured into Igor Stravinsky's L'Histoire du Soleil suite too, but that piece, created before the 1918 pandemic, was not as easy to imagine, even though it was created for a theater company. Stravinsky figured it could tour and bring in money during a tight economic time, because that pandemic shut down everything. The Soldier's Tale did not accomplish its goal. Music director Ryan Haskins said the work had roles for a soldier, the devil, a dancing princess, and a narrator. Because his music was not as evocative as Copland's, it was hard to imagine what was going on. Easily, a narrator may have added to the suite and given the percussion finale more meaning. The full piece runs much longer, but the 20-some minutes accorded the symphony's audience was enough. Interestingly, Haskins used small groups for the four selections. Richard Strauss's Serenade for Winds opened that evening. William Grant Still's Serenade for Flute, Clarinet, Harp, and Strings closed it. Like a Goodnight Kiss, Still's Serenade, featuring Jeannie Oakham on harp, gave Allred and Jacques another opportunity to show how well they worked together. Their valedictory, though, was Appalachian Spring. Both had the same take on the music and, like Graham, found ways to make it dance. Saturday's concert promised a low-key trek through spring-like songs, but with that Pulitzer Prize-winning piece, it delivered more. The Allred-Jacques pairing is one that might be worth revisiting in the future. That was a review by Bruce Miller. We're going to move on now. Over 80 people killed in hospital fire in Baghdad. A death toll from a massive fire at a Baghdad hospital for coronavirus patients rose to at least 82 on Sunday as families search for missing relatives and the government suspended key health officials for alleged negligence. The flames were described as volcanoes of fire and swept through the intensive care unit at a hospital in Baghdad, which tends exclusively to COVID-19 patients with severe symptoms. Officials said the blaze also injured 110 people, was set off by exploding oxygen cylinder. A nurse was called to the scene late Saturday to help evacuate patients. In other world news, in Indonesia's military on Sunday officially said all 53 crew members from a submarine that sank and broke apart last week are dead, and that search teams have located the vessel's wreckage on the ocean floor. The grim announcement comes a day after Indonesia said the submarine was considered sunk, but not merely missing. Did not explicitly say whether the crew was dead. The oxygen supply would have run out early Saturday, 3 days after the vessel went missing. We received underwater pictures and are confirmed as parts of the submarine. Okay, in other world news, we have the price of gas. The average U.S. price of regular grade gas jumped 2 cents over the last 2 weeks, up to $2.96 per gallon. A moon probe. China will launch its next robot lunar lander in 2024 and will carry equipment from France, Sweden, Russia, and Italy. Plans for Chang's 6 to land near the lunar South Pole and collect samples for return to Earth. All right, we're going to continue on now. Last evening was the 93rd Annual Academy Awards. The Oscar is full of firsts. Chloe Zhao's No Man Land, a wistful portrait of itinerant lives on open roads across the America West, won Best Picture on Sunday at the 93rd Academy Awards, where the China-born Zhao also became the second woman to win Best Director and the first woman of color. The No Man Land victory, while widely expected, nevertheless capped the extraordinary rise of Zhao, a lyrical filmmaker whose winning film is just her third, and with a budget of less than $5 million and featuring a cast populated by non-professional actors, ranks as one of the most modest-sized movies to win Hollywood's top honor. Her next film, Marvel's Eternals, has a budget of 40 times that of No Man Land. Only Catherine Bigelow, 11 years ago for The Hurt Locker, had previously won Best Actor. No Man Land is a plain spoken meditation on solitude, grief, and grit, struck a chord in the pandemic-ravaged year. It made for an unlikely Oscar champ, a film about people who gravitate to the margins took center stage. I have always found goodness in the people I've met everywhere I went in the world, said Zhao. This is for anyone who has the faith and courage to hold on to the goodness in themselves and to hold on the goodness in others, no matter how difficult it is to do that. With a howl, No Man Land star Frances McDormand implored people to seek out her film and others on the big screen. Released by the Disney-owned Searchlight Pictures, No Man Land premiered at a drive-in and debuted in theaters, but found its largest audience on Hulu. Please watch our movie on the largest screen possible, and one day, very, very soon, take everyone you know to the theater. shoulder to shoulder in that dark space and watch every film that's represented here tonight. Soon after, McDormand won Best Actress, too. The win put her, a previous winner from Fargo and Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, in rare company as a three-time acting winner. Only Katharine Hepburn has won Best Actress more times, and that was four times. In the night's biggest surprise, Best Actor went to Anthony Hopkins for the dementia drama The Father. The award had been widely expected to go to Chadwick Boseman for his final performance in Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. Hopkins was not in attendance. The most ambitious award show held during the pandemic, the Oscars rolled out a red carpet and restored some glamour to the nearly century-old movie institution, but with a much transformed and in some ways downsized telecast. It was a year when, to paraphrase Norma Desmond, the pictures got smaller, were overwhelmingly seen in the home, not on the big screen, during a pandemic year that forced theaters to close and prompted radical change in Hollywood. It was also perhaps the most diverse Academy Awards ever, with more women and more actors of color nominated than ever before. Sunday brought a litany of records and firsts across many categories, spanning everything from hairstyling to composing and acting. It was, as some observers said, a sea change for an awards harshly criticized as Oscars so white in recent years, leading the Film Academy to greatly expanded membership. The ceremony, fashioned as a movie of its own and styled as a laid-back party, kicked off with opening credits and a slinky Regina King entrance as the camera followed the actress and One Night in Miami director in one take as she strode with an Oscar in hand into the LA Union Station and onto the stage. Inside the transit hub, trains kept running, nominees sat in a cozy, lamplit table around an intimate amphitheater. Some moments, like Glenn Close getting down to debut, were more relaxed, but the ceremony could not shake off the past 14 months. "It's been quite a year and we're still smack dab in the middle of it," said King. Daniel Kaluuya won Best Supporting Actor for Judas and the Black Messiah. The win for the 32-year-old British actor was previously nominated for Get Out, what was widely expected. Kaluuya won for his fiery performance as the Black Panther leader, Fred Hampton, whom he thanked for showing him how to love myself. "You have to celebrate life. We're breathing. We're walking. It's incredible. My mom met my dad and they had sex. It's amazing. I'm here. I'm so happy to be alive." While cameras caught his mother's confused reaction. Some Oscar-worthy moments. Hair and makeup team make history with a win. The hair and makeup team behind Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, Sergio Lopez Rivera, Mia Neal, and Jamaica Wilson, made history while they were nominated for the Oscar. With Neal and Wilson being the first Black people recognized in the category, and now they are winners. The team transformed Viola Davis into a 1920s blues singer, Ma Rainey, who in the Netflix adaptation of August Wilson's celebrated play is seen during the course of one day spent largely in a sweltering Chicago recording studio. There are precious few photographs of the real-life Ma Rainey, so the team had to extrapolate much of its work from additional research. Another Oscar-worthy moment was a fourth win for Denmark. Raise a glass for another round. The film from Denmark, directed by Thomas Vinterberg, has won the Oscar for Best International Feature Film. "It is beyond anything I could ever imagine," he said, "except this is something I've always imagined. This is the fourth time a film from Denmark has won in the category." Another Oscar-worthy moment, Pixar does it again. The movie Soul won the Academy Award for Animated Feature at the 2021 Oscars on Sunday night, making it the 11th film from the storied animation studio to take the prize since the category was created in 2002. And an Oscar for Octopus. My Octopus Teacher, a tale of an eight-limbed creature and her human companion, won the Oscar for Best Documentary. 10 years in the making, My Octopus Teacher began as a personal video project by South African filmmaker Craig Foster, to rekindle his connection with nature by observing an inquisitive female mollusk while free diving near Cape Town. We're going to move now to the world of automobiles. Put it to the test. When shopping for cars, be sure to try out the technology before you make your decision. New vehicles are brimming with technology that can enhance convenience, connectivity, and driver safety. But the tech can also be unfamiliar to car shoppers, especially those who have not purchased a vehicle in the past 5 years. This poses a problem when it comes to the traditional test drive. There's a learning curve with any new piece of technology, and some automakers make it easier than others. It's one thing to evaluate familiar vehicle attributes such as acceleration or seat comfort, but how do you evaluate new gadgets in a 15 to 20 minute test drive if you don't know what they do or what to look for? With this in mind, experts share some of their car technology evaluation techniques and how to safely learn and test these features. Number one, ask for more time. During a test drive, you're usually given 20 minutes or so. Ask if you can deviate from the normal procedure and get more time. Evaluate the cockpit. When you first get inside the vehicle you're interested in, familiarize yourself with the surroundings and controls. You may have to turn on the car to activate all the screens. Where are the audio controls? Where are the climate controls? Can you reach them easily? Poke around and play with the non-driving controls. Use the USB cable you brought to test the connection for your Apple CarPlay. Test the informational system. There's touch screens and touch pads and rotary knobs and buttons. Test it on the road and see how it feels. Here are five of the best-priced new SUVs for 2021. The SUVs top nearly every automaker's sales charts, and they're not cheap. Any given SUV costs a few thousand more than its closest sedan counterpart. To help ease the sticker shock, these experts have compiled a list of five SUVs that come in a variety of sizes, that scored highly in our overall ratings, and have unusually low starting prices for their competitive segments. What's more, automakers are now offering impressive standard features, so affordable does not always mean basic. A base model of any of these five could be all the SUV you need. They are the 2021 Kia Soul LX with an MSRP of $18,765. It's an extra small SUV that offers a large cargo space capacity. It's fun to drive, and the tall roof and wide door openings allow easy access. The second one is the Hyundai Tucson. Its compact SUV includes an impressive amount of standard equipment in its base version. It has a 17-inch wheels, Apple CarPlay, and a 6-speaker audio system and several helpful safety aids. It retails for $24,885. The Volkswagen Atlas has the lowest starting price of any mid-size 3-row SUV. On top of that, it currently maintains a strong fourth place in the rankings thanks to its spacious interior, comfortable demeanor, and quiet ride. Power and fuel economy with either available engine leaves something to be desired, but it's good enough to overcome any flaws. It retails at $32,575. The Ford Expedition, when you get to large truck-like SUVs, there's a lot of similarity. Each is spacious, powerful, and capable of towing. But the Expedition stands out because it has the lowest starting price in the group and has the greatest assortment of standard equipment. 18-inch wheels, fog lights, push-button start, hi-fi hotspot, a co-pilot 360 suite of safety features, which is our favorite. And the last one is the Hyundai Santa Fe. The Santa Fe got a significant overhaul for 2021, giving it standard features for the class. Another highlight is the warranty coverage. Every Santa Fe comes standard with a 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain plan. Both engines are more powerful and have higher EPA-rated fuel economy than their 2020 counterparts. There's also a new hybrid option. The Santa Fe is something of an in-between crossover, straddling the line between the small SUV and mid-sized SUV. It trails rivals like the Subaru out back in cargo space, and the ride can be a little bumpy. But Hyundai threw its might into the standard features: fog lights, four SUV ports, 8-inch touchscreen, wireless Apple CarPlay are all included for $28,000. Okay, we're going to turn now to sports and what's happening in the world of sports. Well, the Sioux City Musketeers draw Omaha in the first round of the conference finals. If they want to advance to the conference finals, they'll have to do it without one of the team's most valuable weapons, the home fans. On Saturday night, the Musketeers closed out their regular season with a 4-1 win over Fargo to clinch a third number three seed in the USHL Clark Cup Western Conference playoffs. Sioux City and Omaha ended the season tied in the standings, but the Lancers held the tiebreaker and secured the number two seed with their 4-0 win over Tri-City. With the number two seed, Omaha will host Sioux City in the best of three Western Conference semifinals beginning Saturday. In the regular season finale against Fargo, the Musketeers battled back from a one-goal deficit by scoring three times in the second, with two of those goals coming from forward Carter Loney. In the third period, Sioux City added one more thanks to an empty netter from Brian Karabis with 1:53 left in the game. For Loney, the goals were his 7th and 8th of the season, and he finished the regular season with 19 total points, tied for 9th on the team. "I just thought we were moving pucks. I got a great pass by two guys. They kind of set me up, and I finished it off." The Musketeers outscored Fargo 9-3 in the two-game series. With their postseason destination tied to Omaha's game, the Musketeers did their best to keep their focus from wandering. The main goal on Saturday was to get one more victory in front of home fans. "We really, to the guys' credit, spend our energy on things we can control," said Luke Strand, the head coach. "I know it's a cliche, but we control our controllables. Our opponent is going to show up, whether we do or not." He knows what to expect against Omaha this weekend. The Musketeers and Lancers have played each other 7 times this season, with Omaha taking the first 3 and Sioux City winning the past 4. The most recent matchup between the teams came on April 10th when the Musketeers beat the Lancers 2-1. With Omaha, we're familiar with them. "We're 7 games into this thing, and I like the idea that we're familiar, but it's going to be a test." Okay, in college volleyball, Kentucky defeats Texas to win its first NCAA volleyball title. Madison Lilly did everything for Kentucky volleyball Saturday night. The Wildcat setter runs the most efficient offense in the country, dished out 53 assists against Texas in the national championship match. She also anchored the defense with a match-high 19 digs. Her biggest play came at the net, with Kentucky clinging to an 18-16 lead in the third, with the match tied at 1 set apiece. The 5'11 senior delivered a solo block on a 6'2 outside hitter, Skylar Fields, that propelled the Wildcats to win the set. Lilly, who was voted the tournament's most outstanding player, led Kentucky to its first national championship with a win of 20-25, 25-18, 25-23, 25-22 in front of the 5,100 fans in Omaha at the CHI Health Center. Kentucky coach Craig Skinner called the performance by Lilly, who was the player of the year earlier in the week, one of the best of her decorated career. Well, congratulations to the Kentucky Wildcats. Okay, in the world of baseball, the Brewers shut out the Cubs. The Milwaukee Brewers played 3 series against the Chicago Cubs in April and won each one. "We've done our job," said manager Craig Counsell. So they beat them 6-0 on Sunday at Wrigley Field. The Sioux City Bandits dropped their first game of the season on Saturday night as the Bandits fell to Salina on the road, 53-24. Sioux City scored first as veteran offensive star Fred Bruno took a handoff 18 yards into the end zone for a 6-0 lead. But after that score, Salina hit back with 26 consecutive points before the Bandits could get back on the board. In college softball, SDSU 9, USD 1, And then in the second game, SDSU 10 to USD's 2. College golf. South Dakota women's golf team is currently fourth place going into the final round of the Summit League Championships. The Kentucky Derby is back on the first Saturday in May, slowly bringing with it the sights, sounds, and rituals familiar to Louisville. Local officials and business owners are hopeful that translates into a better cash flow after the coronavirus pandemic upended the Derby schedule last year. The Thunder over Louisville air show and fireworks display that kicks off Derby activities resumed with resounding booms last weekend. Marathons and cycling races conducted virtually last fall went off live this weekend with thousands of yellow rubber ducks bobbing in the Ohio River in the Kentucky Derby. Tourists are steadily trickling back into downtown hotels, restaurants, and museums. The most anticipated scenes loom in Saturday's 147th run for the roses at Churchill Downs, with women in big colorful hats and men in seersucker suits, occasionally pulling their required face masks aside to sip on bourbon and mint juleps and puff on cigars. "It smells like the Derby," said Kinsey Kapp, who owns a business that makes headpieces and is relishing in a boost in demand for masks to match her hats and fascinators. "In the fall, it was different. It's so good to be back on the Saturday, first Saturday in May. It feels good and right and at home." We're going to continue on now to the area of finance and business. Do you need a 529 plan? If you're saving money for educational expenses, you may want to look into 529 plans, which come in two key varieties: prepaid tuition plans and college savings plans. With prepaid tuition plans, you pay for all or some of the costs of college tuition, usually at an in-state public school, essentially locking in today's lower rates. If a student decides to attend an out-of-state or private school, you may lose some of the value of the account. There's a separate private college 529 plan available also, with nearly 300 private colleges and universities participating. Note that 529 prepaid tuition plans are not guaranteed by the U.S. government, so look into the risks and see if the plans you're considering are guaranteed at the state level. With the college savings plan, you simply accumulate money in an account over time where it grows free of federal taxes. When funds are withdrawn for qualifying college expenses, they're also free of federal taxes. Each plan has one custodian and one beneficiary, though many people can contribute to the account for the student's benefit. Every state but Wyoming has one or more 529 savings plans, and you can choose to save with just about any of them. You don't have to use your own state. The funds in the 529 plan can be used at more than 6,000 U.S. and foreign colleges and university. A key advantage of 529 plans over any other education savings accounts is that they have high contribution limits, often allowing an account value of $300,000 to $500,000 or more. Read up on tax issues if you want to contribute more than $15,000 in a single year. Underpriced IPOs. How can an IPO be underpriced is the question. The answer: companies traditionally go public, introducing their shares for trading on the public stock market via an initial public offering or an IPO. Here's how it typically works. The company hires an investment bank, which can bring in some other banks. The company and the banks decide how they price the shares. Let's say they have determined the company is worth $10 billion, and they're selling 10% of it to the public to raise $1 billion. You may say they might say, sell 100 million shares at $10. On the first day of trading, initial buyers will get their shares at the offering price. That raises the expected sum for the company. After that, the shares will be traded on the market directly between buyers and sellers without raising any more money for the company. If there's great demand, buyers are willing to pay more, sending the price up. When the company's shares soar on its IPO day, that suggests they were underpriced. It could have set a higher initial price, which would have generated more money for the company. I think that's about all the time we have today. I'm going to circle back now. We'll just do a recap of the weather for the week. Looks like we're getting some early summery weather today. Today in Siouxland, high of 85, with winds from 10 to 20 miles per hour and a few clouds. Tonight, it'll be a little cloudy and breezy, high of 50, low of 57. Tuesday, cooler with a shower and thunderstorm, high of 71, low of 47. Wednesday, 65 with some sun and clouds, low of 41. Thursday, sunshine with some breeze in the afternoon, high of 71, low of 43. And Friday, partly sunny, nice and warm, high of 80 and a low of 47. All right, well, that takes us to the end of our reading of the Sioux City Journal for today, which is Monday, April 26th. My name is Barb. I've enjoyed reading for you today. I hope that you have a great week ahead. Thank you to the Sioux City Journal, and thank you to the Iowa Reading Radio Network. Take care and have a great week.
In the People's Pharmacy Health Headlines, flu season should be winding down, but the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention are warning about a second wave of influenza peaking in the southeastern U.S. Earlier this year, tests showed that the most common strain of flu virus was H1N1. Now, however, the H3N2 strain is becoming more common. That's the strain that caused such a terrible flu season last year. Both strains are covered in this year's flu vaccine, and experts report that the flu shot reduced the number of cases that needed medical attention by 47%. There is a new oral antiviral drug this year called Xofluza. One dose is all that's necessary to shorten the duration of influenza symptoms.
The first really new antidepressant recently won FDA approval for treatment-resistant depression. Esketamine nasal spray will be sold under the brand name Spravato. Physicians and patients have been eagerly awaiting the arrival of this new type of antidepressant. They may be shocked by the price. People starting on this medication will need twice-a-week dosing for the first month. The list price is roughly $600 to $900 per dose. That means the initial month could cost as much as $6,800. After that, people will require once weekly or twice monthly nasal spray administration. Those costs would range from $2,300 to $3,500. At the end of a year, Spravato could end up costing $45,000. Some insurance companies may balk at that expense.
For years, health experts have been telling people that exercise is critical for good health and that walking is great exercise. dog ownership can contribute. People who walk their dogs regularly get more exercise than people without pets. A study published in JAMA Surgery highlighted a downside of this otherwise pleasant activity, however. Dog ownership has increased in the U.S. over the last decade, but so have broken bones among older people out walking their dogs. Such fractures doubled between 2004 and 2017, with the majority of broken bones in women. About half of the breaks were in arms, wrists, or fingers. The other fractures, unfortunately, were more concerning. About 17% of the broken bones were hips, a situation that can have serious negative consequences for a person's mobility or even survival. The scientists recommend obedience training for pets so that they don't tug at the leash suddenly and tip a person over. In addition, it makes sense to match the dog and its temperament to the strength of the owner.
Week after week, the FDA has announced recalls of contaminated blood pressure drugs called angiotensin receptor blockers, or ARBs. So many lots of valsartan, irbesartan, and losartan have been removed from the market that there are serious shortages. To cope with this growing problem, the FDA has expedited the review of additional ARB products. This week, the agency announced that it had approved a new generic valsartan from Alkem Laboratories in India. The FDA reports that its evaluation of Alkem's manufacturing process does not indicate a likelihood of contamination with nitrosamine carcinogens.
New technology that allows for non-invasive imaging of the retina may allow eye doctors to diagnose Alzheimer's disease. The retina is richly supplied with blood through a dense network of fine blood vessels. In Alzheimer's disease, however, this network thins and becomes more sparse. Possibly, this reflects what's happening elsewhere in the brain as well. The imaging is optical coherence tomography angiography. Researchers at the Duke Eye Center compared the retinas of 39 people with Alzheimer's disease to the retinas of 37 people with mild cognitive impairment and 133 people with healthy cognitive function. In addition to the loss of tiny blood vessels in the retina, a specific layer of the retina was thinner in people with Alzheimer's disease. These changes did not show up in people with mild cognitive impairment. This is the second time within the past few months we've heard about the possibility that optical coherence tomography angiography may offer an early diagnosis for Alzheimer's disease. And that's the health news from the People's Pharmacy this week.